Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The inaugural address, the State of the Union, there have been a lot of pronouncements from the White House lately. Now comes the president's proposed federal budget. It's got a lot of numbers, but read between the dollar signs and the 442-page document, and the president's vision and priorities pour through. The budget Congress received today is $2.5 trillion plan that seeks deep government spending cuts in the name of reducing debt. President Bush said it's just what's needed.
People on both sides of the aisles have called upon the administration to submit a budget that helps meet our obligations, our goal of reducing the deficit in half. Over a five-year period, and this budget does just that.
But South Carolina Congressman John Spratt, ranking Democrat on the House Budget Committee, says there's no way the budget will address the deficit.
When you discount for what this budget includes, it's not apt to happen, and then correct it for what it excludes, it has to happen, this much is clear. This budget will not put us on a path to halving the deficit in 5 years. It will put us on a path to endless deficits and mountainous debt.
Tonight on Point, the Bush budget and the message in the numbers. You can join the conversation. What do you read between the lines of President Bush's budget? What's the story in the pain and priorities here? What would you do about the deficit? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Mike Allen, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. He's covering the president's new budget proposal and the politics surrounding it. Mike Allen, thanks for being with us tonight. Hello, Mike Allen. Are you there, Mike?
Good evening. I'm with you.
Hi. Good to have you, Mike. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Mike Allen, dive in with us here. I know it's 442 pages. It's dense. It's thick. But give us an overall sense here. We're looking at the proposed budget for fiscal 2006. It won't kick in until October. But broad stroke, what's here? What's not? What's changing in this proposal?
Well, Tom, what we're seeing here is the kickoff to a discussion of some really grand questions that include what government should do, what government could afford to do, and those may have some very different answers right now. What's maybe getting the most attention in the budget is the list of 150 programs the president wants to eliminate or zero out, as they say in Washington, or drastically curtail. 48 of them are in education. They touch a lot of different people, migrant workers. There's a subsidy for the Postal Service. There's a subsidy for Amtrak. And interestingly, a number of these are areas the president talked about during his campaign. Now, the administration will tell you that some of these are being taken up. Some of these functions will be taken up elsewhere, but that they say this would save $20 billion just this year. Now, I've been talking to congressional leaders about this, and they say that of those 150, there's no more than two dozen, probably somewhere between 12 and 20, that Congress will agree to cut. Now they may, or will agree to eliminate. Now there may be some reductions, but there's a lot of these are all very politically sensitive, and even Republicans are going to object to a number of these.
So the first thing you raise here is the difference between a proposed federal budget and what actually goes into effect come October. We'll talk about the politics of that. But the president's making a statement as much as anything. He must know in advance that he's not going to get everything he wants in this budget.
You're right. The president, this president does not want his legacy to be as the huge deficit president. And so this is a way to sort of try to retool or repair his image, renew his image as a fiscal conservative. And this puts Congress in a little bit of a box because a lot of these Republicans ran as fiscal conservatives. People were tight on spending. And they've been complaining for the last 4 years about how much money the Bush administration has been spending. So now you get some touchy cuts, and they see that it's very difficult.
So how would you describe, in general, the direction in which the president's budget would push the country, the cuts that he wants to make? He says it's a very lean budget. He makes no bones about it. In fact,
You know, he says it as a point of pride. So does Vice President Cheney over the weekend. They've seen some big, big deficits, historic deficits, right, open up during their tenure. And as you say, they want a different legacy. But when you go for big changes like that, it changes the shape of government, as you say, Mike Allen. What's the change? Well, how would you describe it?
Yeah, well, Tom, you mentioned the Vice President's interview on Sunday on Fox News Sunday, and he said, you know, we didn't just do this with a meat cleaver. And the administration says, and they will provide you backup about this for specific programs, that these programs either are not efficient or are not doing what they said they were going to do, or that there's no way to evaluate what they're doing, which, of course, is something quite different. Now, you remember the first budget director, Mitch Daniels, the Blade, he was called. He's now the governor of Indiana. He'd worked in the Reagan administration. And he developed a color-coded – there's something about color-coding in this administration, right? They love color-coding.
Right, right. Terror alerts and budget priorities.
Exactly, exactly. But he developed a way of evaluating programs, and it's called PART. And I believe it's Program Assessment Something Tool. And PART – and this is just asking programs to justify – what they're doing, for the managers to prove that they're doing what they say. And so the case that the administration will make is that most of these programs are either things that the government shouldn't be doing or are things that they won't do well. Now, you ask about priorities. What struck me most about this is you see the president looking down the road. He doesn't have to worry about re-election politics now. And so where you saw the big increases this time, besides defense, which has gotten all the attention, is in international spending. The president's Millennium Challenge account, which is a type of overseas aid.
This is to fight global poverty.
Exactly. Thank you. And aids overseas. Those are getting big increase. So the president doesn't have to worry as much about West Virginia and Ohio as he did, and now he's starting to look at how the United States is being perceived. And one congressional leader told me, you can see the footprints of the new Secretary of State in this budget, Condoleezza Rice, who's very close to the president, and I think she wants to repair the U.S. image as someone who doesn't necessarily work and play well with others.
And talk about domestic politics. The president's even opening up here cut in farm subsidies proposed, very politically sensitive, and including a Republican opposition sure to be there, but he's opened it up.
Well, every farm state is a red state, I will say that. And so these are his people, and there's a lot of people who know a lot more about agriculture subsidies than I do, but I don't think there's anybody you'd get on who would argue that farmers have been slighted over the years. And so I know a fair number of conservatives who are sympathetic to farmers, but are happy to see some change being made.
And it's not that they would go, but they wouldn't go in such big numbers to big farmers. What about on the deficit reduction side? What is the claim that the president's making for what this budget would do, and how's that being received, Mike?
Well, the president says this budget is continuing to put him on the path to cutting the projected deficit in half in 5 years. Now, a couple things that omits. One thing, the deficit was zero when he took office. Now, you can point out, as he does, the enemy hit us on 9/11. There was a stock market recession. There were corporate scandals, blah, blah, blah. There are a lot of reasons for this increased spending. But it is a fact that this is something that occurred on his watch. Also, there are some little monetary games. Numerical games that they play. For instance, they overprojected the deficit and are using that as their benchmark, and that makes it a little easier to cut. But what Democrats are saying about this budget is that that's a fake number because this budget does not include the cost of the president's Social Security program, and it doesn't include ongoing operations in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And which are pretty enormous numbers in themselves. Is that within tradition, Mike, to exclude numbers like those from a budget, or is that kind of special treatment, special handling of those big numbers?
I don't know the answer to that, but I will say supplemental budgets, which is how this Iraq and Afghanistan are being handled, and that is in addition to the normal annual budget, you supplement it by putting in a budget request for something specific. The war on terror now is being considered by the administration as something that goes on, doesn't have a definite end. So what is very unusual is to use a supplemental budget request to fund something that does not have a specific ending point and may be continuing for many years.
Jack Beatty, budgets bring priorities to the fore in a big way. What do you see in this budget proposal?
Well, you know, a year or two ago, Neil Ferguson said that President Bush was President Both, meaning guns and butter, and contrasting him with other American presidents.
Having it all.
Having it all, who didn't have it all, Presidents Wilson, Roosevelt, Johnson, you name it. In wartime, they raised taxes and cut programs. Bush did the opposite. And, you know, if you look at these cuts, if you look at this program, you sort of take the assumption, which I do to most things in government, that politics drives policy. Hmm. Well, what are the politics here? I mean, Amtrak goes through a lot of blue states. It's Joe Biden's favorite form of transportation there from Wilmington, Delaware. Housing programs, again, largely
cuts and cuts.
Urban.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The election return showed that people earning less than $25,000 voted for Kerry by 63%. They're going to be hurt by that. Block grants to cities, similarly. So it fits into a sort of picture of we remember our friends and we don't reward our enemies.
And yet those big cotton farmers are out there somewhere, Jack, in that red South. Mike Allen.
Yeah, exactly. And there's coal in West Virginia. That, there may be some truth to that, but there are a lot of exceptions here.
Cuts in a lot of directions. Mike Allen with The Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
We are talking about the Bush budget and the American deficit, American priorities. You can join the conversation tonight. Does a 1% reduction in discretionary domestic spending sound like too much to you at a time of record deficits? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush budget and the American deficit, American priorities. You can join the conversation tonight. How would you describe the vision, the priorities of President Bush's proposed budget? Is it realistic to exclude the costs of war, Social Security privatization, and Medicare from the budget balancing arithmetic? And how do you hear the burden being shared in this budget? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by our news analyst, Jack Beatty, and right now from Washington by Isabel Sawhill. She's Vice President and Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Isabel Sawhill, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
And also with us from Washington, Eric Engen. He is research scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies tax and budget policy in the U.S. economy. Eric Engen, thank you for joining us tonight.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Isabel Sawhill, first to you. What do you see in this great big proposal? Lots of ramification. What jumps out at you?
Well, I think what jumps out at me is that there's a lot of talk about this being a tough budget, and in many respects it is. But all of the pain is concentrated on a very small segment of the budget, specifically on those domestic programs that have to be addressed as part of the annual appropriations process. And much of the budget is either still going up, defense, of course, and homeland security, but equally importantly, all of the major programs that provide benefits to a growing elderly population, such as Social Security and Medicare, are a huge part of the budget and are still growing quite rapidly. So all these cuts that you were talking about earlier, a little bit like taming an elephant with a fly swatter.
So just, you've got discretionary spending, which you can cut. You've got entitlements, very difficult to cut. And you've got security requirements, which in the middle of a war are difficult to turn away from. How might the ratio of these been different?
Well, don't forget there's also the whole question of what we're doing with revenues. And recall that we did have surpluses back in 2000 before this president took office. And we've had a major turnaround in the budget from one of annual surpluses to very large deficits in the neighborhood of $400 billion a year. Mm. And about three-quarters of that deterioration is due to the fact that the president and Congress have cut taxes four times in a row now.
And so you're looking at the revenue side. So if you want to know about deficits, look right there. Eric Engen.
You have to look at both sides, what I'm saying, but
yep.
We shouldn't forget about the revenues.
And we won't. We'll look at that. Eric Engen, American Enterprise Institute, conservative, can't be happy with what happened to U.S. federal deficits in the last few years. Does this budget change the outlook, in your view?
Well, it takes a small step in the right direction. Certainly, one of the things that conservatives have complained about the Bush administration in the first term was the lack of restraint on the spending side. Even outside of defense and homeland security, people were very concerned about growth in other components. As well, one thing that Bell didn't mention that certainly conservatives were very concerned about in the first term was the passage of the prescription drug benefit add-on to Medicare, which I agree completely with Saul, that the long-term budget problems come when the elderly retire, and that prescription drug benefit just added on to the already astronomical costs that are going to come about on the side of Medicare.
And it cost a lot more than the president's people were saying it was going to cost. But let me ask you, you would be sensitive then to whether or not the deficit-cutting advantages, as described by the White House, are for real here, or they're eyewash. The Democrats, we heard some of them earlier, saying this is eyewash. This won't really cut the deficit. You're a deficit hawk. How do you see it?
Well, I think, you know, clearly you look at the sum of all of the budget policy proposals in here. Like I said, it's a step in restraint on the spending side, which is good. But clearly, over the next 4 years, the remainder of President Bush's second term, the biggest impact on the overall budget outlook is going to be the economy, and if it continues to grow at a good clip as it is now. There just is not that much overall in terms of dollars proposed in this over the next 4 years to have a really big effect on the deficit. Much of it will come from continued economic growth.
But the president factors that in. There are economic assumptions in here that lead him to say it will cut the deficit from this, admittedly, a projected high that they never hit, but we'll cut it in half.
Right.
Do you buy that? Do you think it will be cut in half? And does that put the deficit on a longer term, looking beyond 2009, on a path toward reduction, real reduction?
Well, there's two issues. The near term being essentially to the end of his first term and the long term. First, in the near term, the big uncertainty that could go the wrong way is that Congress has to act on this budget proposal now. And as was alluded to in some of the earlier conversation, both Republicans and Democrats have preferred programs, and any kind of budget constraint in a lot of those are going to be hard for individual House members and senators necessarily to pass. And so the first thing is to see whether Congress goes along with the spending guideline. The other is that although this budget does have money for an extra supplemental for this fiscal year, 2005, which will be spent out primarily this year and the following 2 years, there is not extra money in place for Iraq and Afghanistan and other components of the war on terror in further years out. And a big question is how expensive is that going to be going further out? That's the near-term issue over the next 4 years.
After that is
the retirement of the baby boomers.
And on it comes like gangbusters. Jack Beatty, Isabel Sawhill raises the revenue issue here. Of course, this budget presumes, I guess, that President Bush's temporary tax cuts will be made permanent.
It does. And if they are, the tax cuts enacted in 2001 and 2003 are adding about $250 billion to the deficit in fiscal 2005. If they're made permanent, that will add something like $4.2 trillion over the next 10 years to the deficit. So if you were to take these programs, which really, low-income programs account for only a sliver of the total budget, 6% or so. If you were to project those and say, we're going to cut these programs, going to cut subsidies for farmers, that's certainly a good thing. We're going to, and if you were to project those as a way to cut the deficit, and on the other hand, you were to look at these tax cuts, well, it just does seem, if the issue is cutting a deficit, it does seem disproportionate. I mean, last year, $89 billion went to the top 1% in tax cuts. Would it be a cause of revolution to say, well, top 1%, you're going to have to pay for the war, and we're going to deal with the deficit partly by cuts, but also you're going to make your contribution. But that's just off the table with this president.
Isabel Sahil, how do you see that, the issue of the temporary tax cuts likely to be permanent by this Congress, certainly President Bush supporting that? Do they boost economic growth and therefore help out on the revenue side, or is that just a loss to balancing the budget?
I think at best it's about a wash when you cut taxes, as we've done, and don't pay for the cuts except by borrowing more money. The reason being that on the one hand, lower taxes do encourage people to work harder, to invest and save more, to take a few more risks. But on the other hand, if the government is having to borrow all of the money, which it is right now, to cover those tax cuts, then the government is in the markets competing with the private sector for the very limited amount of savings that we do in this country. And that will eventually have an effect on the productivity of the private economy and the rate of economic growth and our standard of living, which will offset any positive effect from these better incentives. So all of the experts who've sort of looked at both sides of this question say it's probably a wash at best and possibly a negative effect on economic growth.
A wash, but this president is sticking with it. Let's turn to our callers. Bernie's calling from Eastchester, New York. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air.
Yes. I guess I want to make, I know it's kind of a question statement. You can take off with it after.
Let's hear it.
My concern is with when you have this president, I think he's off track, and I feel like as a government should be supporting and taking care of the nation and, you know, helping the infrastructure of this nation and, like, you know, instead of cutting programs to essential to helping youth in this country and for environment and for our own living here, we're spending money overseas and it doesn't seem to come back to help us. And that
are you talking about money being spent, let's say, on the war in Iraq, or are you talking about money, foreign aid to poor nations? Which?
More like money on Iraq and Afghanistan and other wars and conflicts. I mean, I do think it's good that we have money going to help with, like, foreign relief, like with, like, the tsunami disaster or for, like, HIV/AIDS or for other things like that. But at the same time, our youth are not getting educated. We're cutting programs of education and the environment, the well-being of future generations in this nation. And I feel like this president and the group around him, they just seem to be out of touch with society. And, like, where isn't the government supposed to sort of help the society grow? There was a time.
Bernie, I think we got to take care at home. Thanks for your call, Eric Engen. How about it? How do you see it? On the one hand, these very, very large expenditures for war abroad. On the other hand, needs at home and concern among liberals and conservatives about the competitiveness of the U.S. economy and how young Americans are being prepared to compete in a global economy. How do you add it up?
Right. Well, I think the interesting thing is that, I think it's correct. One of the most important things we can deal with is the young. But clearly right now and going into the future, most of the budget, bigger than the defense budget, is spent on the elderly through Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. But on the one specific area that's very important to young people, and that's education, because that helps prepare them for being able to compete in an increasingly competitive economy, both domestically and internationally, is education. And if you look at over the first 4 or 5 years of the Bush administration, education spending expanded very quickly and much more than, say, under the Clinton administration. clearly it is the case that state and local governments still spend the most on education, but certainly in the area of education, this president has not been skimpy, and in fact, many conservatives have complained that he has allowed the education department budget to expand too fast. So I guess I don't see where skimping on the youth has been a part of the budget process over his administration.
Isabel Sahil, how do you see it? Investing in America, in America's youth, or disinvesting?
Well, I think that the caller's question, the thrust of it, is right, that we probably aren't investing enough in future generations. But Eric is right that this administration has actually increased spending on education at the federal level by about 50% since they took office. Now, a lot of the programs that they're cutting, in fact, one of your earlier participants said that a third of those programs are going to be in the education arena, and that's true. But what they're doing is trying to restructure those programs in a way that will provide states more flexibility and put more of the money into improving basic K-12 education and less of the money into a lot of more specialized, narrowly targeted programs that the federal government probably doesn't have much business being in the first place.
So it sounds like you're describing that as a good thing.
Yeah, I think it is. But on the but Eric is also right that so much of the budget is now dedicated to the elderly that, you know, that's a problem, and that needs to be addressed. And we need to probably talk about Social Security at some point and Medicare. But if I can go back to the costs of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've already spent $200 billion, roughly, on those wars, and probably we're going to spend another $400 or $500 billion before we're done. So that's a big chunk, and this is the first time that we have not paid for a war. In other words, when we fought the Vietnam War, when we fought World War II, or earlier wars, we usually raised taxes to pay for them.
Entirely? During the period of the war?
During the Vietnam War, President Johnson put a surtax on both personal and corporate incomes to help pay for that war. And so I think what's different this time is that we are not being asked, the public is not being asked, to sacrifice anything to help pay for this war. All of the sacrifices being borne by the young men and women who are fighting overseas, and now through the pressure on the budget that growing defense spending is causing, more indirectly, we're going to be cutting back some of these programs that help less advantaged families.
So there's a kind of shift there, and not to mention the deficit that gets passed on to Americans not yet born. Marty's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Marty. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
I think we should probably look past just balancing numbers and sort of examine what the president's proposed budget says about his moral vision. And it seems to me that the large tax cuts are there to they're just to sort of help out and encourage the rich who they feel are successful, and that actually social programs hurt the poor by not encouraging them to work on their own.
That's the president's vision as you read it.
As I read it. And it's a feeling, though, that the more progressives who might be thinking about budget should probably question that vision, and that maybe we want to promote a better America through investment in children and education and social welfare.
And not necessarily a trickle-down approach, Marty. We've got it. Thanks for that. Jack Beatty, Marty's putting his finger there on, you know, how you come around to helping the poor, and the skepticism is right there about the president's approach.
Well, yeah, there doesn't seem to be much there for the poor. And, you know, it's in contrast to the two other deficit reduction efforts of recent years, 1990 and 1993. In 1990, under Mr. Bush's father, there were cuts in the budget but to deal with the deficit, but taxes also went up on the most affluent. And the earned income tax credit, which goes to the working poor, was actually enhanced. That actually, it was there. They increased that even in the context of cutting the budget. President Clinton did the same thing in 1993. Taxes went up pretty much on the affluent. There was a gas tax. budget restraint, but earned income tax credit that supports work up increase. Nothing like that from this president.
Not this time out. We've got to take a short break here. Isabel Sawhill, Eric Engen, please stand by. Jack Beatty, we're talking tonight about the Bush budget and the American deficit, American priorities. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it wise to cut programs for the poor while making permanent tax cuts primarily for the rich? Is GOP Washington getting serious here about the deficit, or is this just posturing? Will Congress spend away? And what would you do about the deficit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush proposed budget for fiscal 2006 out today and the American deficit and American priorities. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Isabel Sawhill. She's with the Brookings Institution. And in Washington, Eric Engen. He's at the American Enterprise Institute. Our own Jack Beatty is with us as well. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Andrew's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Tom, how are you? Great program.
Thanks, Andrew. What's on your mind?
The conversation has generally focused on outflows, and I just wanted to bring up a point about inflows to the coffers of the United States.
Such as?
I just wanted to bring up the point of corporate welfare. I don't think anyone's really talked about that. In a recent issue of Multinational Monitor, I can't remember the author's name, and I can't cite the specific statistics, but it was really quite a eye-opening expose for me about what kind of taxes and tax burdens corporate America is responsible for, and it really seems to me like they're shirking their responsibilities.
You're saying how little is paid in corporate taxes?
How little is paid and how much they get back from the federal government. And I think we spend a lot of time talking about personal tax cuts, mm-hmm. but I think piggybacked on the back of these personal tax cut bills were quite a lot of loopholes for corporations to extend their ability to pay less tax.
Yeah, we've got it, Andrew. Let us pick that up. Eric Engen, how about it? Again, you guys have a conservative shop going there. What do you make of what's called corporate welfare? Is that contributing to the deficit?
Yeah, it certainly is, and it has for quite a long time. And I think, you know, if there's one thing in almost universal agreement across the political aisle is that people don't like corporate welfare. You know, I can cite a number of studies that have been written by conservative economists as well as more liberal economists that cite that as a big problem. One of the things, though, that needs to be emphasized is that the recent tax cuts were focused on the individual side. There was not explicit tax provisions for the corporate sector in the 2001-2003 tax cuts of President Bush.
I think Andrew's suggesting he would have liked to have seen some attention there in terms of closing some of those loopholes.
I agree. I mean, I personally would. I know others that would. Part of the problem is our corporate tax code is so big and unwieldy, and moreover, actually our corporate income tax rate is the second highest amongst competing countries. Japan's is the only one higher.
But it seems like almost no one's paying it anyway, so what does that matter?
The reason that matters is that it gives an incentive for companies to locate overseas because they face a lower tax rate over there. Moreover, the code is so complicated that you know, armies of accountants and other financial analysts are there to assist corporations in avoiding the tax. It's one of those things that we would like to fix, but it's just very difficult without an almost complete overhaul of the corporate tax code. And there, I would agree with the caller that a complete reform of the corporate income tax is necessary.
Isabel Sawhill, I want to come at this from another angle for a second. Does the president deserve some props, some credit? I mean, he is going after farm subsidies for very large agricultural interests here, getting subsidies of more than $250,000, I think. He's also taking on some defense industry, what you might have thought of as sacred cows. They're cutting Air Force advanced fighter plane programs, a stealth Navy destroyer program, cutting the next generation of nuclear submarines, or at least postponing them, even cutting funds for the sacrosanct for a long time missile defense program. In some ways,
the B-52 as well.
So, here isn't the president getting into some what have been kind of GOP sacred cows? He's taking them on.
Yes, I think we have to give him some credit for that, and I think that particularly the attempt to cut back on farm subsidies is a particularly courageous stand. We did have some real effort to reform the agricultural subsidies back in the mid-1990s, I think it was 96, and then we had a farm bill in 2002 that reversed all of that. And was a part of a growing government subsidy of that area.
Which is funny because, that was Bush, too, and he gave that huge farm subsidy program.
That's right, and that was much criticized, just as the Medicare prescription drug benefit and its huge cost was criticized by conservatives. So this is a good thing. The usual charge here is that you have a very small number of big agricultural businesses, wealthy farmers who are getting most of the subsidies. They don't go to the prototypical small family farm, by and large.
And what about the issues of Social Security and Medicare? They're two huge ones, but in terms of getting any kind of handle on the deficit, you've got to address those. Those are running on separate tracks here. The president doesn't include the cost of his plans or proposal for Social Security reform. Is there a realistic handle in this whole big picture on those costs and what they mean for the budget, for the deficit?
Well, as we said before, this is where the budget really is a problem. This is over 40% of the total money that we spend right now is on these big programs for the elderly. And they're growing extremely rapidly because the baby boom is going to start to retire soon. The first ones will retire in 2008. And right now, of the two programs, Social Security is bigger than Medicare, but it won't be long before Medicare surpasses Social Security and grows at a much faster pace because healthcare costs are growing so rapidly. So I think the president has to be commended for having the courage to tackle Social Security as an issue.
But he hasn't really talked about getting the deficits there in line yet,
no,
right?
No, that's right. I was going to go on to say the problem there is that he's talking about some kind of reform, but the only way you can have an impact on these deficits and on the budget is if you either raise taxes or cut benefits in the program, either raise payroll taxes or cut benefits that go to beneficiaries. And he's eliminated or taken off of the table any kind of a payroll tax increase. So that leaves only benefit cuts if we're going to bring that program under control. And so far, he has not been willing to specify any particular benefit cuts.
So we're still waiting on that. I want to get another call here. Philip is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Philip. You're on the air.
I always just think it's a revenge on President Bush at 6% that he's cutting out the social programs. DC-37 never voted for him. Every city union from California to Texas to Chicago to New York, and now he's getting back because it's a power game. Because now he's telling you, if you don't do this for me now, we're going to cut you more come 2008 and everything. When you say 6%, what are we talking about in numbers? We're talking several million people out of work and everything because he has the power. We did not vote for him as city workers in these social programs and everything because we've always been for the Democrats. But I say this here and now, think on your own two feet. Don't let the union or anybody else read the issues.
And you see the president coming after unions that didn't support him in the election here. Philip, we've got it. Eric Engen, on balance, what do you think is going to come out of this? Congress is going to come in. We heard from Mike Allen at the Washington Post earlier. He doesn't expect more than two dozen of these programs to actually end up being cut. So do we have a real effort with this GOP-dominated Washington to go after the deficit coming down the pike or not?
Well,
Even if you have a smaller group of the cuts that are actually incorporated, to any degree that there's some spending restraint from over the prior years, that is good. But this is where a lot of the complaints that have come out of Congress, particularly on the Democratic side, but also by Republicans that have complained not so much about the deficit, but increasing spending, where they got to put at least the taxpayers' money where their mouth is, in the sense that they're going to have to start making the hard budget decisions that they have complained about before. But the big issue long term, you know, I completely agree with Bell. We would agree on, I think, the numbers is that in 3 years the baby boomers start to retire, and the big increases in projected costs of Social Security and Medicare, in addition to a large and growing component of Medicaid, are going to put budget pressures on that are going to make these current ones look like nothing.
Like and patty cake, like almost trivial. Jack Beatty, we've just got a half a minute left. There's been a lot of talk about a Starve the Beast program afoot with the Republicans to suck away any money that would be there for discretionary government spending. Are we on that path now?
Well, we're at the lowest level of federal revenues to expenditures since 1959, and that was before the major expansion of federal spending with Medicare and Medicaid and other programs. So we're on our way pretty much since I think it's 16% now is what we get in revenue of GDP, and our spending is 20%. So there's a starved beast right there.
Well,
and I don't know that this particular group of cuts is going to narrow that gap at all.
We will watch the warfare over each of these cuts as it hits the floor of Congress. Eric Ingen at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Isabel Sawhill, Vice President and Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
In a moment, we'll check in on Condoleezza Rice's travels around Europe and the Middle East. This is On Point. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice landed in Rome today, halfway through an 8-day, 9-nation tour that takes her through Europe and parts of the Middle East. It is her first official trip abroad as Secretary of State, and one that the Bush administration hopes will mark a fresh start with European allies. Her trip comes at a moment of movement in the Middle East. Today, both Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said in Egypt they will tomorrow declare a formal ceasefire, a breakthrough that comes after both sides also accepted invitations from Secretary Rice to meet with President Bush later this spring. Tomorrow, Rice heads for Paris. Andrea Stone is correspondent for USA Today. She's traveling with the Secretary of State. I asked her how Condoleezza Rice is feeling about her trip so far.
So far, it looks like it's going pretty good. One of the big missions that she had was to mend relations with our European allies. And so far, although we haven't gotten to Paris yet, which is tomorrow, looks like she's doing just that. We were in Berlin earlier in the weekend, and she and Gerhard Schroeder looked like they were just having a fine time. I think since last Sunday's election in Iraq, that the attitude here in Europe is that, okay, that was then, this is now, let's work together to try and make democracy work in Iraq and try to make democracy work in the rest of the region.
What's the message that Condoleezza Rice is bringing, and what's the face that she's showing? Is she changing the Bush expectations of Europe in the Middle East? Is she bringing the same kind of stridency that we've heard out of Washington towards some old allies recently?
I don't think there's been any stridency. You know, we joke here in the press corps that it's the democracy and liberty tour or the freedom tour. You know, at every stop she talks about how we need to build democratic institutions throughout the Middle East and the world, not just in Iraq, in Iran, in Palestinian territories, in Ukraine, at every stop. We were in Warsaw, Poland the other day, and she remembered the first time she'd been in Warsaw in 1979 when it was still a communist country and how there was a very long struggle in that country to end communism. It took a long time, but it finally happened, and I think that's what the Bush administration is kind of hoping, that this is a generational thing. Democracy is not going to come overnight. It's something you've got to keep at, and that's her message.
U.S. relations with Europe have been historically chilly. Now this new overture comes, and it comes from a very different, new kind of face for an American Secretary of State. How is she being received as a personage?
It's interesting. We went out to a dinner tonight with her near the Pantheon, which is this beautiful ancient Roman building here in Rome. Mm-hmm. And we were walking through the square, and people started applauding, you know, which you don't think of in Europe. The people, there's a lot of anti-Americanism here, and I don't really know if they were tourists or not, but it was just interesting to see. She's new. She's been in all the headlines. Pictures of her have been on the front pages of all the newspapers in every country we've been in. It's almost like a rock star in a way. I think it's a new face. I mean, she's a, you know, an African-American woman. It's just a different kind of thing, and people are, they're curious about it, really.
But she's also famously close to George Bush, who has been quite unpopular in Europe, at least. Does that show up? Is there still an edge on the European reception or not?
Well, I think, you know, in a way, the Europeans maybe feel a little bit easy with her, because while they liked what Colin Powell stood for and they liked his positions, they never quite knew whether he was speaking for the president or really speaking for what he hoped the president would say. When they speak to Condoleezza, they're hearing what the president wants. They're hearing his position, and there's really not a lot of air in between there.
She's been in Israel and spoken with Palestinians in the last 48 hours. What was her message for those hoped-for partners in Mideast peace?
Yesterday, she met with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. She had dinner with him. And this morning, we went to Ramallah, where she had a media lunch with Mahmoud Abbas, the newly elected Palestinian president. And she came bearing some news that she was going to be naming a security coordinator, which is a level above an envoy, if you will, but to try to work with Palestinian security forces and work to monitor the disengagement of Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip and from parts of the West Bank, which is scheduled to start this summer. Since Yasser Arafat's death in November, there's been a series of what they consider hopeful signs, hopeful progress being made. And her attitude and the Bush administration's attitude is that as long as it's a step-by-step process and the Palestinians and Israelis and their regional neighbors are making little steps toward peace, that the United States will take a hands-off or at least a low-profile approach. Not to say that they're not involved, but right now they just don't want to make a big deal out of it because that sort of sets up expectations, and they don't want to do that.
But there's been a call for the U.S. to get involved, to get things back on track. Is she saying the U.S. is not prepared to do that?
Today she said, you know, we are going to be very involved. We're going to do whatever we can. But, you know, she said this a few times on the trip. She says, you know, not every effort has to be an American effort. But right now they're very pleased with the things that have been going on, really just since Arafat died, which is not that long ago.
One of the last stops coming up tomorrow, Paris. France has been a particularly difficult partner for the U.S. under George Bush. What does she have planned for her itinerary there?
I think that's a big question. Tomorrow in Paris, she's going to make what her aides are calling the major speech of this trip. She's going to talk about democracy and how the Europeans and the United States need to have a common agenda to spread peace and democracy throughout the world. I think what's going to be interesting to see is the French are going to take the attitude that the Germans took earlier this week, that we're going to move on from here. We're going to try and make this thing work in Iraq, regardless of what we felt before. You know, that was then, this is now, and we're going to move on from there. So I'm very interested to see how it'll go tomorrow in Paris.
We'll be listening. Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today, traveling with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She spoke with me from Rome. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skoke, Michael Garth, and Angel Cazelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. A special welcome tonight to the listeners of our newest affiliate, KCPW, in Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.